Hello and welcome to Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. This is Wade here, joined in the studio by Mike, as we are recording the first of what we hope will be a number of Winging It sessions on the topic of what most Christians experience on a Sunday, at least Christians from liturgical churches, when they make their way to church and they make their way through the divine service. And so this series will be walking through the common service as it's been known to many Lutherans in the Epiphany episode, which may come out after this. We just recorded it earlier, but Mike references a little bit how influential the Book of Common Prayer has been on English-speaking Lutherans. So the common service, as many Lutherans know it, whether that be what's in Christian worship or in the Lutheran service book, it's kind of shaped all of these services. You could go to a Roman Catholic Mass, an Episcopalian service. You're going to see similar things in many instances. We're going to walk through what you might see and why are Christians doing that? What value might there be to it? What we're not going to be doing is getting into worship wars. So we'll be posting these things. If you have questions, we would encourage you, as always, shoot us an email. We're happy to answer. We're going to avoid any debates in the comments, hopefully, about, well, my church does this and your church should do that. But we want to get at just why has the church done some of these things? What's the thought behind it? And maybe in some instances, if we do this, how can we do this well? But we're thinking, if you are attending just kind of a run-of-the-mill, somewhat average, common service, influence service, what might be you be seeing or experiencing? And so I'm going to be leaning on Mike a lot in some of these episodes, as he'll be talking maybe sometimes about more technical aspects of the liturgy, but I'll be jumping in, as I like to do sometimes, with what I think can really be unpacked theologically with some of these things that take place. This is a somewhat long introduction into the topic, and that's just, once again, there's two things that are very personal to most Christians. And the first is their Bible. Whether they read it or not, they have a connection with it. They realize it's special. And the second is their experience in the divine service. We tend to picture it with a pastor who particularly influenced us, maybe, and a particular building that was very meaningful to us, even if we've had several churches throughout life. And so it can be very easy for us to associate things with our experience. I remember serving a shut-in once when I was new to a parish I had served, and I had been ordained, and everybody was wearing a white robe except one pastor who was the black sheep. He had a black Geneva. And I wore the white robe because I looked at the pictures in the back, and that's what the pastor before me was wearing in confirmation pictures. But I went to visit a shut-in, and she must have seen a picture of what I was wearing, a picture of my ordination, and she was very concerned, what would Luther think about me not wearing a black robe? And we had a wonderful discussion, but she had been a shut-in for a while, and I don't know when the previous pastor had gone to white, and maybe she had forgotten what the pastor before me had wore. But this was really filled with meaning for her, because this is what she had seen the person bringing her the Word of God wearing. And I didn't begrudge her at all being concerned about this. And I think end of the day, we could both agree, regardless of the robe being worn, bringing Jesus is the main thing. But I just want to introduce, again, as you listen, we get people have had different experiences, and people may even have different preferences. I oftentimes joked with my people, I knew I did the service well when no one was happy, meaning not everybody got their way in every single way. And that's really what the church year and the church service does, is grounds things and roots things in not only what do we want, but what do we need. And so we're definitely going to be approaching this from a somewhat historic standpoint. Once again, the influence of the common service on English-speaking Lutheranism, but also from just a theological standpoint of, if you see these things, and maybe you don't do this at your church, maybe you visit another church and you see these things, what meaning these things can have. And that's not to say all of these things in and of themselves have some special meaning. We like to do that sometimes too, where pastors will say, well, the black robe symbolizes original sin, or the white robe, the righteousness of Christ. Well, it can symbolize both those things if you teach it, but in and of itself, a robe doesn't teach anything. It's adiaphora. But we do want to get at how these things can serve as powerful teaching moments or reminders for us. So, Mike, you're probably a little disheartened that I'm opening with all these cautions. I think sometimes maybe I'm too nervous about how these things develop. Any thoughts on any of that before you get us started on what you want to get us started on?
Yeah, sure. Maybe a couple preliminary things. We did a full episode on worship before, and I think it would be it's a nice preliminary to this series. One of the things we mentioned was that you really have three options. One is you can just preach and without any kind of ritual, don't teach any kind of symbolism. And that's a bare minimum, and that's fine. But the caveat there is you still have a ritual, even if your ritual is trying not to be ritualistic. The second option is we have our rituals and we do them, but we never teach them. And that can be you fall into the trap of either going through the motions and become highly ritualistic, but even if you're kind of a low ritualistic person, it just because this is the way it was done, wouldn't Luther be upset at you for not wearing the black robe? And then there's a third option, which I think is the best option, is that you appreciate the role of tradition and ritual. You're not bound by it, but you teach it, and you teach that Luther would have wore a white robe and stuff like that. And that way, it becomes the Sunday morning experience becomes a teaching thing. It becomes more fulfilling. It gauges all senses, stuff like that. So, and the only way you can do that is to really kind of laboriously teach it and go through this. And it can be an exciting thing, even if you're not a person who is into art and symbolism. You can still learn this stuff, and I think you'll enjoy it. And so that's what we're hoping to do. We're just going to go from the beginning, and it may take 20 winging it. We have no idea how long it's going to take. We're just going to kind of go piece by piece and see where it goes. Maybe one other thing about those worship wars, that idea of clashing over styles and stuff like that. That was a phrase that came out of more Protestantism than Lutheranism, although it fits certainly with decades gone by in Lutheranism. What was missing, I think, in those conversations was a concept of coming into the presence of God. And I remember sitting talking to a classmate of mine in postgraduate school. He was an Assemblies of God guy, a really sharp guy. And I was the only Lutheran in our cohort, our group, and they were very respectful to me. I think I mentioned this before. They called me the token Lutheran of the group. And there's a lot there, a lot of stories there that are very interesting. I'll focus in on one right now. We're talking worship. He's like, I just don't get it. And he was one of the Protestants that would group all Lutherans in with Catholics and maybe Christian, but probably not kind of thing. And I went to a Catholic funeral once and it was so boring and this, that, and the other thing. And I said, well, because you didn't know what was going on. You didn't understand why the pieces were there. And he begrudgingly agreed. Okay. He said, and then he kind of said from his very spiritual, plain Protestant view that we didn't need all that extra stuff or that it wasn't what was with all this ritual and he didn't get it. And I said, well, you understand. And again, he was a smart guy. This was doctoral work. So he was not a novice to the different theologies that were out there. And I said, well, you know that Lutherans believe in the real presence. I said, yes. I said, well, if Jesus is there, that kind of changes the way you do things, don't you? And the light bulb went on for him. And he said, you know what? I never thought about it that way. And it was helpful for him to understand the other side of the aisle there, so to speak. And I think that's what's been missing in our concept of worship is coming literally into the presence of God. The worship wars were done in a modern worldview where both sides kind of saw the world in a modern way, where the spiritual is sort of there, but not really there, not that important. And so worship was a utilitarian thing. What works is going to be the way we're going to do it. Utilitarian way at looking at what truth is, even what works is true. And then the opposite side was keeping traditions for the sake of tradition's sake, and then trying to find symbols for what we did, instead of saying Jesus is really here, and so we act in a certain way because Jesus is here, not because we have to, but because if you go to a state dinner at the White House, you dress a certain way, you act a certain way, not because you have to, but because that's what it calls for. It's a natural kind of thing. And that brings us into the beginning of the divine service winginets that we kind of start with.
And I'll just note briefly, Mike mentioned that it might take us 20-some weeks. I went in, as we were talking briefly before this episode, because we always very carefully script out each episode beforehand, as you can tell by listening. And I said, okay, so we're starting with the beginning. We're going to do invocation. And Mike reminded me that that's not necessarily the beginning. So I'm curious to see just how many sessions we can turn this into.
But, I believe that we'll get to invocation maybe today, next time for sure.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Bible study where I'd say we're going to do a book of the Bible maybe 3 weeks. And then 3 weeks in, I'm about 8 verses in. So, Mike, I'll let you get us started with what you have is the beginning of what many will encounter in a divine service.
Many of you probably begin with the bells, and bells are rung, and then church begins, and it's a cool thing. It has no real scriptural basis at all. You can maybe look to the trumpeting of Jesus coming in Revelation, maybe. But that was a very practical thing, and many of the things that we still hold on to in our traditions began as practical things. You know, before stopwatches and wristwatches and clocks and all that kind of stuff, bells were used to call people to church. So even in our parish in Minnesota, the ushers had to come a half an hour early to ring the bells. And then when the service started, there would be the bells there. So that's kind of a call to worship. It's a unique thing, but it doesn't really have a biblical basis. The next thing that will happen, not always, but many people have at least witnessed this. Everybody has witnessed it at a funeral or a wedding, is a procession. A processional is basically a parade into church. And it has a long, long history in the church's history of worship. Often it began with the pastor or maybe the town's bishop coming to a local congregation. Again, without alarm clocks, people would gather Sunday morning, and then they would sing songs. And then when the pastor came in, there was kind of a parade, and it would grow up that way. As a natural thing that would happen, the pastor would then come to the altar into the presence of God and then begin the service. And there's actually a couple entrances that we're going to have in the service. One is an introit, and this would be a processional. Now, just to think about processionals, this is a natural thing that we humans do. I can't think of a culture or an era where people didn't have a parade. We have parades, and they mark things that are important to us.
Football players run out the tunnel.
July 4th, weddings,
we
funerals.
Rise for the president when he walks in, or whatever the case may be.
There's all sorts of parades everywhere, and that's one way we human beings, and it's universal, is we say this is important. And maybe just a word about that kind of universality of all this. Many of the stuff that we're going to talk about here are universal throughout all cultures and places. God created us in a certain way. For instance, he created us as people who eat, drink, and speak. There is not a family reunion in the history of mankind where you didn't do those three things. He created us that way, and it makes perfect sense then when he comes to us, he's going to come to us in word and meal. And so things like that. The other thing about universality, and Wade alluded to this when he talked about the English-speaking Lutheran world and Anglicans, Episcopalians. If you're Roman Catholic, even if you're Eastern Orthodox, many of the same parts of the liturgy are the same. Part of that is the history. Most of it comes from the synagogue. I get a kick out of somebody who says, well, that's just a Northern European thing that you do on Sunday morning. Actually, it's more Jewish than anything, if you know the history of it all. But it's also a really cool thing to think about when you're reciting the Nicene Creed, or you're hearing the prayer of the day, or you are singing the words of an offertory, or you're hearing the words of institution, that those are the same exact words that are being sung by a boy in Buenos Aires and a girl in Beijing and countless Lutherans in Ethiopia and Nairobi.
Yeah, this sounds like a commercial.
All these things. It kind of does bother me when somebody says, well, this is a Northern European German thing, this Sunday morning, page 15. It's the exact opposite. When you throw away this thing that is more universal than blue jeans and McDonald's and replace it with something that is, let's say, uniquely American, you end up becoming less diverse, even though you were trying to be more diverse by throwing off the shackles. And there's a lesson there about the Enlightenment in the modern world, isn't there? That when we try to become enlightened, we end up becoming very narrow-minded in the end.
Well, and it's striking to me, and I'm one who sometimes too will be sensitive to that, especially when people will say, well, that's just German. There in our hymnody, I think someone could maybe argue our hymnody has been heavily influenced by European hymnody, and there's a good reason for that, because people knew the languages or could translate those languages easily. And people who came to America from European settings brought those hymns with them. But when we're talking about liturgical practice in the liturgy, Mike mentioned in the Epiphany episode that will be coming out soon, there was very little that the Lutherans added on outside of the Nunc Dimittis and then Transfiguration in the Epiphany season. In a day and age where we are concerned about appreciating different cultures and things of that nature, it's always kind of interesting to me that we dismiss something as belonging to one culture that is in actuality one of the more universal things that mankind has, which is a divine service whose bits and pieces largely reflect the contribution of all sorts of cultures. And as Mike said in his very commercial-like presentation, I was picturing, you know, a boy playing soccer in Buenos Aires and whatever else. The human race has just left its fingerprints on this throughout time. And it has shown a small C Catholic, universal, right? Not big C Roman Catholic, but small C Catholic, an ability to relate to and be impacted by various cultures, peoples, times, to kind of stand above. And so, I think there's a real value in that reminder that Mike is bringing us, and that in many ways it while it is not syncretistic, it's not, this is not, you know, and this is the part we got from Zoroastrianism or whatever the case may be. At the same time, it recognizes, and I know Mike is big on this and does work with this, you know, human flourishing and just what is, it recognizes what it is to be human. And as humans, there's just certain things we do. We come together, and so we ring bells to assemble or whatever there's an air horn at a hockey game or whatever the case may be. But then we do, we like to introduce important things taking place and oftentimes marking them, singling them with this procession, saying, look at what is about to happen. And I don't want to steal Mike's thunder, but even many processions, what they are marked and led by, what we face, reminds us an important thing of what's taking place. And I in my own mind, have the custom at our own home parish, which does not have a procession every Sunday, but does on festival Sundays, what in the end marks the procession. But sorry to jump in there, Mike. I'll let you keep going.
No, those are some good thoughts. Just to close up those kind of thoughts about universal things that we share. This is how God made us, and so it's natural that we do this. And other religions may play off of that because that's just natural too, but it doesn't mean that we're grabbing stuff from other religions. It's probably the other way around when you think about it. And I like the idea about being truly human. It,
I knew you would.
It's we've used this phrase a couple times. The liturgy curbs our enthusiasm in a good way, and takes us down the road where we do see suffering, and we appreciate we're face to face with the cross, and we're face to face with the suffering and the martyrdom of the church, and that makes us better evangelists. It makes us more compassionate and sympathetic, even when we don't know that it's actually happening. When we trace our own desires, we end up worshiping what we want to worship, which is finally just ourselves. And so it's good to kind of have that structure. We're never tied to it, but to always remember if we throw something out, there's going to be a vacuum that occurs, and it's going to be filled with something, usually something that's about us.
And if I could just, that you use that term enthusiasm, and you know, Luther will talk about Schwärmerei and things of this nature, and the Small Called Articles, I believe, you know, he says Adam and Eve were the first enthusiasts. And so what Mike is getting at there is, you know, recognizing this very natural human impulse that we have to make our religion either inward, right, we're going to find something in ourselves, or to make it outward but focused on something which ought not to be worshipped but rather should simply be received as gift. But this impulse we have to become the arbiters of what is or ought to be worshipped. And, you know, I mentioned when people will say, well, that's just German, sometimes they'll mean, well, just having an order and structure is a very German thing. Actually, it's kind of like a First Corinthians thing where Paul says everything should be done in an orderly way. And why is that? Because it does, as Mike mentioned, it curbs our enthusiasm. It helps us maintain our proper focus. And if anybody really wonders, well, like, it can't be that easy to lose your focus, read the scriptures. It is chapter after chapter of lost focus, and then God coming to oftentimes through cross and trial to reorient. And think of your own life. I mean, the very things I should focus on most, how easily I lose focus on those. Maybe I go to my kid's game, but then I'm talking to someone or I'm on my phone. I'm not really present for it. You know, I say I'm going to focus on my health. My health's important. But then I find myself dwelling on the same things that I know lead to unhealthy behavior. Or I find myself, you know, at 2 a.m. deciding maybe I should put a pizza in the oven. All these things that should be paramount are the things that we can oftentimes most easily neglect. And so, you know, as Mike says there, that curbing of enthusiasm is extremely important because we have a strong and amazing ability as human beings to miss the point.
Yeah, to start looking at the liturgy as not exclusive but inclusive. If you throw it away, you're throwing away diversity. And to also see it in a positive way, that this is a setting for me to be free and to flourish. If I just follow my own way, that's not true freedom. It's a slavery to my own desires. And so as we look at this stuff, we want to be open-minded, truly open-minded. And so back to the idea of a processional coming
in. Well, 1 second. Just to set the stage here a little bit more, Mike, I think that we recognize in the divine service the symbol that we're at the same time saint and sinner, and that the structure of the service is meant to do two things: to mortify, to tell the old Adam to sit down and be quiet, but then also to edify the saint, right? To build up the saint. And so I want to bring that back because I know Peter and I have been talking about a symbol episode ever since we started the podcast, and we'll have it at some point. But it does intrinsically recognize that we are old man, new man, old Adam, and now the new man in Christ who wants to hear God's word and live for Christ. And so there are things that do both those things in the service too. So it's as much, the liturgy is as much for the old man, right, as it is for the new, setting the stage for that, for word and sacrament, which feeds the new man. I'm going to stop interrupting, Mike. I'll let you get to the procession.
That's good. I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things I did want to talk about is the divine service is an epic kind of thing. Literally, heaven and earth are going to come crashing together. There's going to be a death and a resurrection, a death of the old man and a resurrection of the new man once again. And to start thinking about the Sunday morning as an encounter with God, an unsafe thing, because he is an all-powerful, almighty God, and yet a very safe thing because he is Father to us, it is something that is a huge deal. And when you get out of the mindset of just going through the motions, if you get out of the mindset of saying, what is the pastor going to entertain me with today? Or what am I going to learn today?
Consumer mindset.
Yeah. And start thinking about, I'm literally coming into the presence of God, and heaven and earth are going to come crashing together, and it's going to be for me. It becomes something grand. And something that's been rattling in my head for a couple of years now, and I haven't had a opportunity to say it or write it somewhere, is in an official way anyway, this idea that Christianity is something worth dying for. And the history of the church is stained with the blood of martyrs. And when people look at the Christian church today, especially in the West, they kind of shrug, or maybe they'll be critical. Or they maybe go, well, I go to this church because it's nice. I like the guy there. I like the people there. It's a nice message. It makes me feel good. It's a far cry from the earliest martyrs of the faith. Christianity is something worth dying for, but we have presented it as something that's barely enough worthy of getting up in the morning on Sunday. And that's on us, I think. And I'm wondering if the dismissal of the spiritual in the modern era, the dismissal of the sacraments as important, even in the Lutheran Church, the idea of coming into the presence of God, that heaven and earth are literally crashing together, has made it kind of ho-hum. And then you're left with that consumer attitude, how do I get butts in the pews?
Why should I want it instead of prove to me you don't need it?
Right.
And I think you maybe it was in the Epiphany episode, maybe it was this, that there's almost anyone with any level of honesty, maybe they'll say, I don't need the divine service, but anyone with any sense of honesty about themselves or this world is going to recognize they have metaphysical, even if I want to avoid that word spiritual, they have metaphysical or at least beyond themselves needs. And we end up trying to sell the service. And in many, I was talking to my brother-in-law the other day, and we kind of got talking about this. And there's a lot we agree on, and there's stuff we might not see eye to eye on. But I thought he had a couple very helpful thoughts. And he said, you know, Wade, we might not always agree on everything, but I think we both agree that the church has done a bad job of making clear that it does have a message to give the world, right? That it's there for a reason. And he used an illustration of a church in his area, and we're both in the Lutheran context, but different church bodies, that had someone come in and now they weren't even using the sanctuary. It was, you know, we're finding ourselves, whatever the case may be. And as we talked about it, I think we both kind of fell at, you know, change can be good and helpful, but when there's a new selling point every 5-10 years, all you're doing is setting people up to become disillusioned, because you know that the shtick can't stand the test of time. And anyone who's in marketing knows that. You have to come up with it. Ford doesn't run an ad in 1970 and go, okay, we made our point, and that, right? It's got to be something new. And so there's a certain danger when we fall into appealing to the wants beyond the making clear the needs.
Yeah, and one phrase that was given to me is stop asking yourself, what do you like, and start asking yourself, what is God like? Coming into the presence of God. So the processional can be helpful in that. You're literally, that literally coming into the presence of God, this is an epic, serious, dramatic thing. And we are people of drama, created in the image of God. Yes, we have fallen, but we're still these rational creatures created in the image of God and made for something great, and should not be satisfied with ho-hum in any aspect of our life, especially our spirituality and our Sunday mornings. This is a big deal. The another thing about the procession is maybe one more kind of passive-aggressive comment, and then we'll actually get into the meaning of it, is...
We are, if you're wondering, Mike, we are 30 minutes in.
Yeah. If you can have a processional at your wedding, you can have one in church, right? You don't, if you're going to have it in other parts of your life and then say we can't have it in church, I think you got to step back and let me challenge you and say that's maybe a little bit unfair. And for those who say, well, we don't want to do pomp and circumstance in church, first of all, that's probably more on you, and look at me, I'm humble, rather than on Christ. And
I think they're probably thinking of that passage of Scripture where people strew Christ's path with palms and clothes, and Jesus stopped and said,
pick all that up.
And in a Zwinglian fashion, put an end to it.
Yeah. And maybe just another not so passive aggressive comment, but for pastors out there, especially young pastors, don't introduce it. This is way down on the list of things to do. At the same time, we tend to project our own insecurities on our people and say they're going to riot and they're not going to like it and they're going to hate it and they're going to think it's Catholic. Give them credit and teach them. Yeah, you're going to always have people that complain, because there's always people that complain. There's going to be people that are going to go with you just because you're the pastor, no matter what you do. It's what you do with that large swath in the middle. Are you willing to patiently teach them? Are you willing to back off when you need to back off? Are you really willing to go forward and take some hits when it's time to go forward? That's where you're going to do your good work. So anyway, the processional, so we don't go too long here. A standard is something put on a pole that is at the beginning of a processional. So you can think about it, a flag in any number of wars, the United States flag, part of a regiment, or a flag of their own regiment.
If you've ever been to a commencement or graduation ceremony, there'll be flags for the school or for the various departments within the school.
All the same concept. So it's kind of a rallying thing. It's kind of a, this is who we're following. In the midst of battle, you look up and that's where you're supposed to go, kind of thing. Now, for the early church, they would have been very familiar with this because they were familiar with the Roman legions. And I always imagined this, this little village up in the hills somewhere, and they've heard about the Roman Empire and they've seen soldiers, but they're still independent. And one of their shepherd boys up there sees these things glimmering in the distance. Every so many feet, there's a standard, a pole with a golden eagle on top of it. And he can't see it's an eagle. He can just see these things shining in the light. And then all of a sudden it's the original Red Army, right? These Roman soldiers marching, and he runs back to the village and they know what's coming, and great fear falls upon them. And there's only one thing they can do, and that's submit. And so this powerful picture of this standard and this army following this thing on a pole, this golden eagle, it symbolized so much. And then for the church to then put a dying man on a pole and follow him really, really plays out what St. Paul talked about in his first letter to Corinthians, about the cross being utter foolishness. And so we follow a man, not a symbol of great power and might, a theology of glory, but a man dying on the cross. It's a purposely sharp contrast to what they were used to. And so that we would carry that on with this lowly pomp, this pomp and circumstance, but a man dying on the cross, that picture is going to bring to mind 1 Corinthians. And Palm Sunday, and that he is the center focus of the church service. And quite frankly, not just a cross, but you miss this if you don't have a corpus on it. That whole picture of the crucifix compared to a Roman legion's standard with a golden eagle. If you're going to do a procession, that you got to do it. You got to go full way to really get the contrast there of it being played out.
I'm just going to, before we get angry comments, you can do it. You don't have to. You can do it.
You can do whatever you want. You can put a chicken on top of your standard.
Well, don't do that either.
But just the history of it and that contrast is where it comes from. And to really get the full meaning of it, I think it's beneficial.
And I think just briefly, almost any time you've seen secular powers, political powers rise to some degree of totalitarian hopes. Now, I don't mean this has to be a fascist power, but any regime or government that wants to make expansive claims on the lives of people and to move beyond simply claims on people's bodies, but their soul or conscience as well, there's always been a great uncomfortability and antagonism toward the liturgical in the church. And for precisely the reason that Mike is mentioning with how, the Roman eagle in procession, and the Romans had issues with this too as it developed, Julian the Apostate or others later, that these, they recognize the power of these symbols and that, you think of especially these regimes that are all about the state or the nation, when this butts up against nationalism, what a great antidote to nationalism it is to have these international, universal, small c, Catholic symbols. This is why you drape the coffin in the funeral pall, the symbol of baptism. And yes, you may have, we honor our veterans, so we're not going to get into that. But these are sometimes those outside the church recognize better than those inside the church the power of these visuals.
Yeah, and it's been a huge, powerful symbol to the early church Christians. Already in John's day, he is writing to people in his book, in the Revelation of Jesus Christ to St. John, about those suffering persecution. And if you think that's something that's long gone, turn on the news and you're not going to go very many days without seeing a parade in North Korea, or in China, or in democratic societies
America is plenty prone to sometimes people who in their church would never tolerate pomp who will be extremely upset if someone else's patriotism isn't up to par.
Right, and I think we've talked about this before. We here at the podcast are certainly patriotic and for all those things, but you can't be for them in the secular world and then not appreciate the contrast and the traditions of the church fully. I think to be honest, you got it. Not saying you have to do this, that, or the other thing, but you got to be cognizant of them and see how, and that gives you a proper balance between the secular and the spiritual, the two kingdoms, and I would argue makes you a better American. And when you really understand that, where all of that stuff comes from, the separation of church and state, which is, kind of a, what we can debate that some other time, but to really fully understand that and to say, I have the freedom to put my God first before my country. That's truly American. And that does play out in how we show our patriotism, but also how we do our worship too. And so if you're going to get worked up about the flag, good for you. But also then, hey, don't get worked up, but be thoughtful about the images of the church and understand why there was, for instance, a processional and how that was really a powerful thing and sometimes an antidote to perhaps Nazi Germany or other reigns of terror that you were talking about.
And there's accounts, and this is the first wing in it, so I'm going to let us go a little long and I'll add this, but there's accounts of some dignitaries, emissaries from England who went to Wittenberg, I believe in the 1540s while Luther was still alive, And they went to the service, and you know, this would have been the emissaries from Edward, I believe it was, but which Edward's reign leaned towards Zwinglianism, but they are just shocked of it's basically the mass that they're celebrating in Wittenberg. And as someone who does work with the history of the different reformations, I would just note, and I think even Hermann Sasse, who lives under Hitler and then ends up writing a lot on the Lord's Supper and the liturgy, things of this nature. I think you mentioned earlier that your Assemblies of God friend that was in this mm-hmm. wing, and we're recording too much at once today. There is... the power of art and music and image in Lutheranism was really rooted in Luther's understanding of the real presence of Christ and the incarnation, that God had a face. And where you find these things being removed or diminished are in churches that deny the real presence of Christ, or at least don't appreciate it. You know, I always feel hesitant to speak for Calvin too much, because Calvin really wants Christ to be there in some way. And I have a pretty great respect for John Calvin as far as a great mind. And the more I read him, the more I appreciate him, but also appreciate where there's differences that need to be pointed out. But they're Lutheran, you know, if someone's praying to an image or statue, okay, maybe we'll remove it now. But there's just this awareness now of the incarnation as a game changer, and we have a present Christ. And so even in those phases of Lutheran history, when there tended to be an iconoclasm, this fear of images, it almost always was connected on a piety that was not inherently very Lutheran. And so pietism begins with, and that's an episode in and of itself, but begins with some proper concerns about how, dead orthodoxy, as it's sometimes been labeled, had maybe... failed to connect home and church, right? But a result of it becomes, and this happens often, in the name of spiritual things, it diminishes the most spiritual, which is the presence of Christ in the preached word and in the sacraments, which is where all Christians have their common experience. It internalizes it and it personalizes it. And so one of the values of standards or a procession, as Mike is mentioning, is it right? In my home church, when the procession goes, we all turn and face the crucifix as it's coming in. And it's a communal thing. We're all here for that. We need that. We need Christ crucified for sinners. And so it focuses us, but it also is a reminder now of who is present there. And Christ is crucified historically in the past for sinners. And I can't go to his cross now, but the fruits of his cross are brought to me in the absolution, in the pastor's preaching, and in the supper. And so I always find that to be a powerful reminder. Mike is much thinner than me, and Mike, you guys were at church for Christmas Day when we had the procession. And at Nain, our pews are a little narrow. So I always, this takes extra effort for me to be able to turn and face the cross. I kind of get wedged in there. And so it's almost as if God is saying, Wade, extra focus on this, which is always a helpful reminder.
I almost got stuck too. They are very... Maybe just to wrap up this winging it on a practical matter, and then we can end it, and next time we'll get to the invocation. Please stay tuned, because there's a couple battle royales that Wade and I are going to have. One's going to be on the Kyrie, and the other one's going to be on the Eucharistic prayer.
I'm alone in the department, I think, on the Kyrie.
But... So we're going to... There may be some fireworks, like things being thrown in the office and stuff. Anyway.
We'll record those in your office.
Maybe we should get some video for a special video one of that. Anyway, for those parishes out there, pastors specifically, you know, introducing this if you ever get to the point, it can be an easy sell. I hate to put it that way, but it can be an easy sell because you can start an acolyte program with your youth and your confirmation kids. And my experience was that most of them really wanted to do it and were upset if they didn't get their turn. Certainly eighth grade boys are eighth grade boys, I get that. But for those people who are going to be at first, oh, we can never do this will be too Catholic, too, we could use the money on something else, and all of those standard arguments. When they see their grandkids dressed up, participating in church and liking it and wanting to do it, those concerns will go away. It really was a wonderful way to get the youth involved, to get them to teach things. And you may even have to have a conversation with some of your older generation who are constantly telling you about how the young generation doesn't know respect. And this is a great opportunity to have a conversation that says, you can't just have respect for the sake of respect. That's virtue for the sake of virtue, as I say too often. It has to be grounded in show respect to other people because they're creating the image of God and he deserves respect. And if he created us in this way, then human beings deserve respect too. And so to show the respect as one would for our nation and those who have fought for our nation, to show the same kind of traditional liturgical respect for God's divine service, coming into his presence, and then him giving us this world back to us, right? And also these gifts of grace in the divine service. You do that respect first. You teach them that respect first. And that's when respect for everybody else and their own bodies and their own lives, it'll flow from that. And so bringing out if you would start a processional and an acolyte program, I think you'd be surprised to see how many fruitful conversations in your congregation would happen because of that. And that's the whole point of those rituals and those traditions. When you really dig in and teach them, you really start to see the whole picture.
And it, you know, these things become inherently catechetical, which I think is what we want this Winging It series to be. And it will be especially. And when we get to some of those parts that Mike joked that he and I disagree on, those will be especially theological and catechetical too. And I don't think either of us will say the other's approach is sin. But it'll be interesting, I think, sometimes to see what each of us wants to emphasize with these things. But when you do invite the youth to participate, Ziggy was the crucifer the other day in church. Even with your elders or deacons, whatever your church calls them, when you say at this point in the service we do this or that, this is an opportunity to teach, right? We had, many churches have the custom of the elders may bow at the altar when they bring up the offering plates or whatever else. Well, why? Because the altar is a symbol of Christ's sacrifice, right? We're not worshiping the wood of the altar. But these things can become wonderfully catechetical. And so you have your acolytes who go then tell grandma and grandpa, I did this and this because of this and this. And the liturgy becomes a teaching opportunity. I had a big class I put together, Bible information class, adult catechesis was what I preferred to call it, for people who were coming into the church. And it was 15, 16 lessons, but it was all based on the common service. But it went through the chief parts of the catechism. And guess what? They're all there in the common service. And so, you know, a little thing like you're going to be the crucifer or you're going to be the Lucifer, a little joke there, right? Carrying the light, the torchbearer.
Torchbearer.
And the eighth grade boys usually are well suited to be the Lucifers. but these are conversation starters, and it can be a helpful thing. Mike, anything else on this before we wrap this one up?
No, not at all. Let's let the bird fly, and we'll come back later and finish up the divine service.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get with my party and I begin to cry. I don't care what the people are thinking. I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set them up another round. I set them up another round. I set them up another round. One more round won't get me down. I said, honey, I don't care.